At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On the program today, timing the market, but not the way you think. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 9th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The big picture economic news of this day was, in a weird sort of way, that there was no news out of that debt limit meeting at the White House this afternoon. President Biden and Speaker McCarthy, of course, along with Schumer, McConnell, and Jeffries. To be clear, it's not like anybody expected news. Speaker McCarthy and House Republicans are steadfast in threatening the security of American debt. President Biden will negotiate on the budget, he says, not over the debt limit itself. And to be even more clear, as we sit here, just 21 days from when the Treasury Secretary says she is going to run out of room for financial maneuverability, the protagonists in this whole thing lack focus because the markets still haven't decided to start paying attention. We asked Marketplace's Justin Ho to figure out when that might happen.
Stock markets aren't exactly surprised by all this back and forth over the debt limit.
We know the drill. They've just got to solve for it.
Mark Lucchini is chief investment strategist at Janney Montgomery Scott. He says there are plenty of reasons to believe that Congress will sort things out. For one, there are a lot of people that won't be happy if government aid stops flowing.
On June 2nd, about $25 billion of payments are estimated to go out to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security recipients.
Lucchini says he gives it about 1 or 2 weeks before the pressure on Congress starts really ramping up. And right now, markets don't have anything to react to, since nothing's really happening, says Ian Dubecker, a finance professor at Northwestern University.
And when nothing is happening, we shouldn't be surprised that the market is just puttering along as it usually does.
Dubecker says the market could react if, say, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen comes out with more details on who wouldn't get paid in the event of a default. And if nothing keeps happening, that's news too.
You might expect that returns are just kind of a little negative every day or a little lower than they might have been otherwise, because every day of no news, that's kind of bad news.
There are some markets that have already started to react. Winnie Caesar, global head of strategy at Credit Sites, says look at one-month treasury bills, which are going to mature right when the government could default. Caesar says investors are worried those bonds won't pay out. As a result, they're demanding to be paid more in interest.
Investors are looking over that one-month time horizon and saying, hey, we need a little something extra to compensate us for that extra risk.
Caesar says the corporate bond market could start to react, too. That's in large part because a government default could mean less government spending and a weaker economy.
That factors into the outlook for earnings going forward and the ability for corporate issuers to borrow at a reasonable rate.
Caesar says investors across the board will reassess how cautious they need to be depending on how things play out this week. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, equities, to be clear, not a debt limit care in the world. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. you get right down to it, whatever's going to happen with the debt limit, whenever the market really starts to pay attention to it, it's all about stability, right? About financial stability and predictability, having some sense of what is going to happen. On that note, we have been expecting tighter lending standards in this economy, given, you know, the interest rate increases and the bank failures. And that gets us to something called the Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey on Bank Lending Practices for the first quarter of the year, courtesy the Federal Reserve.
I looked at it, and it was about what I expected.
Kara McDaniels at Arizona State University, she helped us explain the survey last month. It's known as SLOOSE, by the way, the Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey, SLOOSE. It's got questions like whether those senior loan officers' banks' credit standards have tightened considerably, tightened somewhat, remained unchanged, or eased considerably or somewhat.
Mostly somewhat tightening, right? So it doesn't suggest panic.
Requirements did, though, get tougher for commercial and industrial loans, and demand for those loans fell. Lending standards also tightened for all consumer loan categories. Demand for credit cards, though, was one of this report's few unchanged categories.
If there's any concern, it's less to do with the consumer right now. The household sector continues to be a little bit resilient.
Households resilient? Check. Business and commercial lending, not so much. Also check, but why?
Economic uncertainty. A little bit of liquidity, a little bit of deteriorating capital position, but largely uncertainty.
For the rest of the year, then, the opinion of those senior loan officers is that there's going to be tightening lending standards across all loans.
I would imagine that some of it has to do with the turmoil. Anytime we are shining a light on banks, everybody's going to be a little more careful.
How careful, though, is the question, especially given First Republic being swallowed up by JP Morgan last week, which, if you're checking your calendar, happened after this survey was done.
The next one will tell us how, after we've processed the whole crisis, how are we behaving?
How are we behaving? The next sluice, August, probably. We'll get the April Consumer Price Index tomorrow morning, and one guesses what the inflation reading is going to be at one's own risk. But that headline number, whatever it is only going to be part of the story, because how much you are spending depends on where you live. Regional variations are real. And inflation in the Mountain West, Montana and Wyoming, all the way down to Arizona and New Mexico, it's been running extra hot there. It peaked at 10% last year, 6% in March. Those are year-over-year figures, of course. And it is, that 6% number, a whole percentage point higher than the national average. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has more on what's driving up prices in the region that she calls home.
The cost of housing accounts for a third of the CPI. So it adds up that the index is running hottest in the Mountain West.
It's cuckoo here.
Here being Bozeman, Montana, where Megan Lawson lives. She's an economist with Headwaters Economics.
Unaffordable housing touches every aspect of the economy and life in these communities.
Lawson says a lot of people have used the newfound flexibility of remote work to move someplace with a view, and those digital nomads can afford to spend a lot more on housing than locals.
So places that have mountains and lakes and rivers are experiencing unprecedented increases in housing prices.
Higher housing costs mean employers have to pay higher wages.
It's going to increase the cost of living and make everything in these communities more expensive.
Rob Godby has seen evidence of that spiral in Laramie, Wyoming.
You know, when you're in a small town, a few people can make a difference.
Godby, a professor of economics at the University of Wyoming, says another thing driving up prices in the Mountain West is energy. He says most of the country has gotten some relief since prices surged last year.
If you look nationally, you know, year over year, you're looking at about a 6.5% decrease in energy costs. Whereas across the Mountain West, probably only about a 1.5% difference.
Thanks in part to an oil refinery shutdown in Denver and some constraints on natural gas pipelines in the region. Then there's the water issue.
The drought, the super drought in the West, as they call it.
John Restrepo heads up RCG Economics, based in Las Vegas.
If, for example, you're able to build fewer residential houses and apartments in a community because you have land and water constraints.
And there's not enough housing to go around in your growing city, then he says that drives up costs and the cycle starts all over again. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
On the theory that if you really want to know what's going on in this economy, all parts of this economy, you gotta just talk to people. And we've got a roster of regulars that we keep tabs on. Sometimes we put those calls on the air. Sometimes it's just a, hi, how are you? Today, it's one of the put it on the air ones. Keith Alverson's a corn and soybean farmer in South Dakota. We first met him, I don't know, got to be 6 or 8 years ago now. Keith, it's good to have you back on.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
It has been, I don't know exactly how long, but it's been a while. How are things in the corn business in South Dakota?
You know, things have been going pretty well. Prices have stayed strong out here in South Dakota. We had, you know, we had a lot of snow, which was kind of a hassle, but we needed the moisture. And so, we've got a nice spring day going on and rain in the forecast. And so we're planting away.
Are you? You're out in the field already planting.
I am. I'm sitting idling in the tractor on the end rows as we speak.
Sorry to bug you on the job.
No problem.
So what kind of yield are you looking at this year? More or less than last year? And how's that going to affect, you know, what you take home at the end of the season?
You know, last year we had a slightly below average crop. And so we're hoping for average or a little bit above average yields. So that puts us right around about 200 bushels an acre of corn. And So, you know, if we achieve that with the corn prices where they're at, you know, that has some really nice profit potential for us. And so we're pretty optimistic going into the year.
I was doing an interview maybe a year ago, I don't know, a number of months ago anyway. And this person I was talking to said, you know, farmers are price takers. They're not price makers. You are kind of at the mercy of whatever the market's telling you it's going to give you for your corn, right?
Yeah, we sure are. You know, I mean, the supply demand picture and I think, you know, even in the last couple of weeks, we've seen about a 10% reduction in the corn price for the crop that we're about to plant. And so, you know, we've got potential to lock some of that in using the Chicago Board of Trade. And so we try and manage those margins the best we can. But there's, there's always some unknowns.
Do you, the guy sitting idling in the tractor at the end of the corn rows, do you actively work and track the Chicago Board of Trade on those prices, or are you just out there trying to get the crop out of the ground?
Yeah, you know, you'll find a wide degree of variation among farmers. Some guys track it, some guys don't. I myself track that, and I, you know, do the trading electronically myself.
Do you really?
Yeah, been doing that for probably about 4 or 5 years that way.
And does that cut out the middleman and sort of increase your margins, or what's the deal?
Yeah, it gives me a little bit more flexibility in some of the timing. And so, it's gotten to be something where I'm comfortable enough with the system that I manage it myself.
Yeah, that's totally fascinating. All right, so let's talk about a couple of other sort of big picture thing. I want to talk inputs now and the fertilizer and all the stuff you have to have ready and at hand to get the crop out of the ground, right? I mean, inflation's got to be hitting you too.
Yeah, you know, it sure is. You know, we saw a lot of the fertilizers like to track with the grain prices. And so if values are up there, then, fertilizer prices are high. And, you know, it's come down over the last couple months since last harvest. But obviously, we'd like to get it as cost effective as we can.
What else is on your mind as you get the crop in the ground and now you're just going to watch it grow for the next 3, 4, 5 months? What else is keeping you up?
Yeah, you know, the weather is always a big thing for us farmers, and so keeping an eye on that. We've come out of a couple years of drought, but, you know, the inflation that we've seen in some of the machinery and infrastructure things that we look at for the farm, and just some of the maintenance and building infrastructure things that we look to do around the farm has been a big issue. It's just a big backlog.
So are tractor and combine prices up too?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're, I don't know if they're double what they were here a couple of years ago. I mean, so it's raised significantly, you know, so we're kind of putting off some of the investments or updates that we were looking to do on machinery, since what we have is in good working order.
Yeah. Yeah. Use it until it breaks. Keith Alverson, he's a corn farmer in Chester, South Dakota. Keith, thanks a lot. Really good to talk to you. I appreciate it.
Thanks. I always enjoy it.
Coming up.
I don't have to drive. I don't have to clear my schedule. I can just kind of like log on.
Telemental healthcare. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 56 today, 0.2%, 33,561. The NASDAQ down 77 points, about 0.6%, 12,179. The S&P 500 down 18 points, 0.5%, 41.19. As I said, debt limit. What debt limit? LinkedIn announced job cuts today. The company said it's discontinuing its Chinese app and laid off more than 700 employees worldwide. LinkedIn is, of course, owned by Microsoft. Shares down 0.5% there. Another 0.5% is the way to say that. Regional bank stocks still volatile. Shares of PacWest bounced slightly today after tumbling last week. That bank shares closed up 2.3% today. Western Alliance declined 1.3%. New York Community Bank Corp. gained about 0.5% as well. The latest survey is out from the National Federation of Independent Businesses. Far more of them predict that the economy is going to get worse rather than better in the next 6 months. Top concerns among those small businesses are inflation. Anybody guess the next one? You've been paying attention? Labor shortages. People, come on. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-note, 3.52%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is a big week for media companies reporting earnings. Fox and BuzzFeed today, Disney tomorrow, News Corp on Thursday. And it's been a not great year for the industry. There have been layoffs and cost cutting driven mostly by a decline in advertising. But if you do read the tea leaves a little bit, you'll see some of the companies who do the advertising look like they're ready to start spending again. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has that one.
The talk around ads in some recent earnings calls has been pretty upbeat.
Advertising and related consumer spending increased approximately 9%.
And you've seen the level of advertising that we're putting back into the business.
As we continue to invest in innovation and advertising and in category growth plans with our retailers.
Those were leaders at Hershey, Colgate-Palmolive, and Clorox. And consultant Brian Weiser says a lot of other packaged goods companies are spending as well.
Surely there's more optimism about the second half of this year, and I think that's well-founded.
Companies in other areas are feeling it too. Automakers, movie makers, bed makers? That is, hospitality. Stephen Jumper, who runs the creative agency Ghost Note, says his firm just started working with a global hotel brand.
I mean, this has been one of the most difficult, if not the most difficult stretch of years for that industry, maybe ever. And so now that the world, it feels like it's back open again, you know, folks are ready to spend.
That's good news for any media platform where advertising has been anemic, says Bank of America media and entertainment analyst Jessica Reif-Ehrlich.
Whether it's television, cable, streaming, as well as audio, any company that accepts advertising will benefit as the market starts to pull back. Advertising is really high margin business.
And a crucial source of revenue. But there's still uncertainty at media companies that don't necessarily know what shows they'll be able to offer to advertisers.
There's a writer's strike going on, and then there may be the other guilds also may be striking. So it's not clear if there will be new content in the fall or will it be pushed back.
Reif-Ehrlich says the government's wrangling about the debt ceiling doesn't help either because it makes advertisers nervous about spending. But lawmakers taketh away and also lawmakers giveth. Reif-Ehrlich says there's already increased spending on political ads. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
The federal COVID public health emergency officially ends on Thursday. It lasted more than 3 years and brought with it some real changes to the American healthcare system, chief among them, telehealth. The growth of that kind of care has been especially strong in telemental health, connecting with a counselor, or a psychologist, or another provider by video or phone or text. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, that has likely changed mental health care forever.
Since pandemic lockdowns and mask mandates ended, a lot of medical care has gone back to being in person again. Not so mental health care. More than a third of it is still delivered via video, phone, and apps. It used to be difficult to get reimbursement for remote therapy under Medicare and employer-based plans. Then came COVID.
I think it absolutely unleashed telehealth in a wholly different way.
Joanne Volk co-directs the Georgetown University Center on Health Insurance Reforms.
They pulled off all the restrictions and paid parity for providers and lowered cost sharing for patients, and it worked.
Medicare, for instance, now covers therapy and substance use treatment via video and phone for all patients, says Nirmita Panchal at the Kaiser Family Foundation.
We've seen uptake in particular rural areas where even leading up to the pandemic, they encountered unique barriers.
like a shortage of providers and long distances to clinics. Urban and suburban folks have also embraced telemental health.
Knowing that I could do it over Zoom was kind of a game changer.
Janelle Nanos is a mental health patient in Boston and a journalist.
Last year, I started on a project that involved some pretty heavy material, specifically abuse against children, and I was just thinking about really hard things.
Nanos has done a lot of trauma coverage and is writing a book about parents who sex traffic their kids. She has two young children of her own. She's never seen her therapist in person, doesn't even know where her office is. There's a $20 insurance copay for every virtual visit.
I don't have to drive. I don't have to clear my schedule. I can just kind of like log on, have that conversation, log off, send her a Venmo, and we're done.
The shift has been a game changer for therapists, too. Katrina Gould has been practicing in Portland, Oregon for 30 years. She sees more than half of her clients by video now and is busier than ever. She does have concerns, though, about missing observations like a patient's body language.
I still 100% prefer to be in the presence of another person. There's a lot of information that I can't get on Zoom.
She gets reimbursed the same amount by insurance, whether a client is in person or on screen. But some other providers aren't so lucky. Insurance companies can set some of their reimbursement rules, says Joanne Volk at the Center on Health Insurance Reforms. And she worries they might actually start to restrict in-person therapy to control costs.
One of the things to keep our eye on is whether or not telehealth is pushed, especially by insurers, to replace in-person visits, that you must use telehealth first or exclusively.
She says some states have passed laws protecting patients' choice to see providers online or in person, and to make sure providers are reimbursed at parity for either kind of care. Volk says there are also concerns around equity and unequal access to broadband, smartphones, and computers. Some studies have shown telemental health has been adopted most by white, higher-income people.
If we've made gaps worse for people who are low income or racial or ethnic minorities, it needs to be watched and tweaked going forward. I don't think we're going back ever, but we need to make sure that access is equitable.
Meanwhile, in most cases, you still can't see a therapist virtually unless they're licensed in the state where you live. But few other pre-pandemic barriers to telemental health care remain. Medicare and Medicaid coverage has been extended or made permanent. Many private insurers now cover treatment via video, audio, text, and chat. Telemental healthcare is here to stay. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, about which you will surely say, yeah, Kai, did not need you to tell me that. Saw this in the Wall Street Journal using data from Microsoft that some of us are spending as much as two full workdays. Let me say that again. Two full workdays in meetings or answering email. It breaks down as 8.8 hours a week on email, 7.5 hours in meetings for the most active users of Microsoft's business software. I am just going to say here, maybe those people are doing it wrong. All right, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. A quick housing data point out from the National Association of Realtors today. Home prices in this economy are falling in more parts of the country than they have in the past decade or so. That is to say, about a third of metro areas are reporting price drops. Out west is apparently bad. Midwest, south, and northeast are doing all right. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the Executive Director of Digital and On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody.
This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.